Thank you, Forrest. As Forrest was speaking, I was looking out over the room. I saw a number of people eager to ask questions. Let me ask you to hold them, and we'll have a robust discussion when both of our panelists have spoken. Also, in looking out over the room, I was, as one has to be, struck by the extraordinary number of truly remarkable people who come together in Philadelphia Society gatherings. And yet, as I looked across the room, I realized there's one person in this room that it's just impossible for me to stand here and fail to acknowledge. As I look around the room, I see other people who've had the privilege of working for him. I see Becky Dunlop, John Curry, John Richardson, Steve Calabresi, Kenny Cribb. I see people he went to school with, like Stan Evans and Lou Euler, and I'm mindful he also went to school with Bill Buckley. He's been one of us from the beginning of his intellectual formation, and he has contributed an enormous amount to the public life of this country in ways that you know about and in ways that you will never know about. When we were privileged to work for him in places like the White House and the Department of Justice, being with him every day and sitting at the conference table to start the day with him was like being in a seminar with a leader who was at once deeply principled and thought a lot about the ideas that undergird political action, and who was also an incredibly successful and disciplined political activist, politician, and administrator. He is altogether undersung by the American people he served so well. He is one of the true giants of the 20th century in America, and I predict that history will record that. He was Ronald Reagan's Attorney General, the 75th Attorney General of the United States, one of our members who sits here humbly in the back pews taking notes and taking it all in, but a real leader of our lifetimes, Edwin Meese III. When Ed Meese was Attorney General, by the way, he fostered within the department serious studies of states' rights and federalism issues. If you're interested in pursuing Forrest MacDonald's thought in this area, by the way, he's got a book hot off the press from University of Kansas Press. I believe it's called Union and States' Rights, or States' Rights, and Union, 1776 to 1876, Imperium in Imperio, and I commend that to you. Tony Blair recently announced the pregnancy of his wife, Sherry, celebrated London barrister, in contemplation of which he expects to be taking leave of office as prime minister for a while to attend to paternal duties. Perhaps it is a commentary on the Thatcher and Reagan legacies that the prime minister of the United Kingdom can take off from work for a few weeks, and the president of the United States can take off from work for a few years, and nobody really notices. We have just heard from Forrest MacDonald about issues of federalism and subsidiarity. Those issues are certainly present in Europe, where the European Union presents in its relations with its national constituent states such questions, and Mr. Blair has put on the docket in the United Kingdom the question of devolution of power to the Welsh, Scottish, and similar assemblies. So those issues are present there, but also present there is the problem of Leviathan in a centralized state in a way that is perhaps thrown into much sharper relief even than it has been in recent experience in the United States, particularly in the post-Reagan era. David Willetts, Member of Parliament since 1992, has written about modern conservatism in a book Penguin published in 1992 by that title. He has also written treatises on practical politics in Britain and a chin-up piece for British Tories following the still relatively recent Labour landslide. I think Mr. Willetts noted that the only previous Labour landslides occurred in 1906 and 1945. Now, those of you who are scientific students of politics will recall that 1906 and 1945 were years when the Chicago Cubs made it to the World Series, which suggests, if my empirical logic is correct, that it's something that Britain doesn't have to worry about too often. He served in Her Majesty's Treasury. He served in the Downing Street Policy Unit that was established by Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Since entering Parliament, he has risen through the ranks of the Tory leadership. He survived the Labour landslide in his own seat. He has been Shadow Secretary of Education. He is currently Shadow Secretary for Social Security. Antonio Martino, a member of this society who was Foreign Minister of Italy briefly earlier in the last decade and is currently the floor leader of Forza Italia in the Italian Chamber of Deputies, and perhaps on his way back into ministry after the recent Italian elections, pronounces him a very good man. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege to present David Willetts, MP.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's a great privilege for me to be here. It's a special privilege for me to speak to you as you've allowed an Englishman to address you. After this morning's discussion, I'm touched that you've allowed a practicing politician to address you. In fact, even worse than being English and a practicing politician, after the landslide defeat we suffered in 1977, I feel like an unsuccessful practicing politician, which is about the lowest form of political life there must be. I wrote a book before the last election trying to set out the case for conservatism called Why Vote Conservative? And my daughter, after we suffered our loss when half, sadly, of my Conservative colleagues in the House of Commons lost their seats, said, yes, Daddy, everybody read the book and they thought, yes, why vote Conservative? So I will try to do better this afternoon. And I would like to begin, if I may, by just reflecting, coming especially from an English perspective, on the links between conservatism as a body of thought and conservatism as political practice. Because I don't think as conservatives that we should be embarrassed or defensive about trying to seek political office and have genuine political influence. And I would like to personally to say how much I personally have benefited from the work of people in the American think tank, some of whom are represented here today, and the position papers they've written and the policy work they have done, which has not just influenced the policy debate for the good in America, but has spread around the world and contributed to the flow of ideas between Britain and America. That activity, seeking political influence, is one that we conservatives, I think, should value. And if you don't take it from me, take it from a far more distinguished British conservative, Edmund Burke, who said the following, that duty demands and requires that what is right should not only be made known, but made prevalent, that what is evil should not only be detected, but defeated. When the public man admits to put himself in a situation of doing his duty with effect, it is an omission that frustrates the purposes of his trust almost as much as if he had formally betrayed it. It is surely no very rational account of a man's life that he has always acted right, but has taken special care to act in such a manner that his endeavours could not possibly be productive of any consequence. That seems to me to be a pretty eloquent case for political practice. And he goes on, making the case for political parties, and of course the inevitable compromises and disappointments that as soon as you're engaged in politics as a member of a wider team. He says, it's the business of the politician, who's the philosopher in action, to find out proper means towards those ends and to employ them with effect. Therefore, every honourable connection will avow it is their first purpose to pursue every just method to put the men who hold their opinions into such a condition as may enable them to carry their common plans into execution with all the power and authority of the state. So I don't believe that as conservatives, we... Does British conservatism exist in order, I hope, to put conservative ideas into practice? We should remember that in Britain, unlike in America, there is a British Conservative Party. And many conservative ideas have been discerned in Britain simply as a result of political practice. Political practice is one of the ways in which we have discovered what conservative principles are about. It's perhaps one of the reasons why Edmund Burke so brilliantly interpreted and explained by Russell Kirk, why Edmund Burke has such an important role in the history of British conservatism. And I'd like to quote another commentator who made this point. And I think it helps particularly to explain the character of British conservatism. This is T.S. Eliot writing in an essay, The Literature of Politics. He said the following. Political thinking, that is, thinking that concerns itself with the permanent principles, if any, underlying a party name, can follow two contrasted lines of development. At the beginning, maybe a body of doctrine, perhaps a canonical work, and a band of devoted people set out to disseminate and popularize this doctrine. So that's the first model. He calls it the mechanical model. He says the theory has altogether preceded the practice. But then he goes on, but political ideas may come into being by an opposite process. A political party may find that it has had a history before it is fully agreed upon its own permanent tenets. It may have arrived at its actual formation through a succession of metamorphoses and adaptations, during which some issues have been superannuated and new issues have arisen. What its fundamental tenets are will probably be found only by careful examination of its behavior throughout its history, and by examination of what its more thoughtful and philosophic minds have said on its behalf. And only accurate historical knowledge and judicious analysis will be able to discriminate between the permanent and the transitory. And that's the second approach, what he calls the organic, political ideas emerging from the experience of political practice, which is the clue to the development of conservatism in Britain. It has been a response to political practice. And conservatism makes sense in Britain as it's been developed by our experience, and of course the recent and most distinguished and powerful contributor to that was Margaret Thatcher. Now, there's not much to be said for a politician in opposition, as we are in Britain, but it does at least enable us to have the time to reflect a bit more carefully on what those basic principles are, the basic principles that drive conservatives. My wife and I had the opportunity of discussing this with dinner with Margaret Thatcher and Dennis Thatcher last year. And Dennis Thatcher, who is a great conservative, was asked by my wife what he thought we should do in the Conservative Party after we'd suffered this landslide defeat. And Dennis Thatcher said, well, what the Conservative Party needs to do is get back to basic conservative principles, but don't ask me what they are. Now I can briefly try to set out what I think some of those may be. And the starting point is the clue is contained in the subject of our discussion this afternoon. The clue is Leviathan. And the point about Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan is that Thomas Hobbes was a contractual social contract theorist who began with pre-social, non-social, rootless, atomistic man and ended up making a case for big government. And there is a connection between that. The connection is that rampant individualism, the liberals' model that somehow you can imagine an individual outside society, pre-society, rampant individual without the ties of duty and loyalty and affiliation is indeed only held in check by big government. And it's the liberal model of the individual and big government which are mutually dependent on each other. And it's the crucial conservative insight, surely, that it is a nonsense to imagine man outside society making some pre-existing social contract. We understand man as rooted in society, in tradition, in history, in culture, and values and morality. That's our starting point, and that seems to me to be the most important conservative insight of them all. And what you experienced in America with your founding was that you arrived at a country which was in many ways a natural wilderness, but you didn't arrive as Hobbesian, pre-social, non-social man. You arrived richly endowed with a European Christian tradition, and particularly, if I may say so, a British and English political tradition of common law and civility and self-government. And that has been, I personally believe, the secret of the great American success. Now, what's happened to conservatism in Britain in the past few years? Well, as the Emperor of Japan said, we had a reference to Pearl Harbor this morning, and I was reminded of the Emperor of Japan's words when speaking to the American people, the Japanese people after Hiroshima. He said, developments have not necessarily proceeded as expected. And that's rather how I feel. We lost badly in 97, and why did we lose? And as so often in politics, the good and the bad are related. We were paradoxically, I think, the victims of our success. When Margaret Thatcher came to office in 1979, the British problem was above all an economic problem. Our problem was that we were the basket case of Europe and our economy was in a hopeless mess. And Margaret Thatcher in 1979 set to work tackling the economic problems in the same way as Winston Churchill in 1940 set to work facing a very different set of military and diplomatic problems. It was the economic problems that were top of her agenda, and quite rightly so. And she applied free market principles and free enterprise economics to solve them. But by the end of our 18 years in office, we'd become so preoccupied with the economic problems that we'd become the economics party. We shone an intense searchlight beam of economic analysis on every problem and every concern of the electorate and forgot the importance of speaking a non-economic language as well. We became like Oscar Wilde's cynics, people who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. In other words, what we lost was the ability to sound like proper conservatives who understood, I think it was Quintin Hogg who said this, that economic liberalism was very nearly true. Of course, free markets are important, but they're not the whole story. There's more to life than that, and we conservatives failed to convey that. And that's what a lesson that we need to relearn now. And the starting point of trying to talk to the British electorate in a non-economic way is to make a different sort of argument for limited government. Not just the economic free market argument, true though that is, but that you need to limit government in order to create the space for all the institutions that stand between the individual and the society. Something that I never cease to admire in American society, the sheer richness of your civil society, non-state collective action. The communitarians, although I'm not a communitarian, but the communitarians are onto something, and we mustn't allow the left to capture that communitarian language. The trouble with the communitarians is that a community is a bit spineless. It's institutions that give spine and backbone to a community, just as values won't do unless they're principles. But if we can have a civic conservatism, a micro-conservatism, if you like, a conservatism that celebrates the strength and the value of the individuals that stand between the individual and the state, then I think we'll be true to our principles and at the same time be able to address the electorate in a language they understand. It means a conservative agenda of strengthening the family. I was fascinated to hear what Professor MacDonald said about states' rights, because it means, in the British context, strengthening the power of the local, including local government. It involves giving schools greater powers to run their own affairs. It involves giving universities greater power to run their own affairs. And it's a recognition that micro-institutions can impose and strengthen norms and codes of behavior and rules of conduct in ways that government and national organizations cannot. There was a fascinating exchange this morning on the role of religion in all this. And I can tell you, coming from Britain, we have a state church. We have nationalized religion, and like every other nationalization, it doesn't work. It's much more effective, because as soon as you start being committed to it as a national institution that has to include everyone, at that point, it has to be tepid to the point of meaninglessness. It's only when you have competing and vigorous churches in the plural that religion thrives. America is an infinitely more religious country than Britain, and the fact that we nationalized our church is one of the main reasons for that. So I believe that it's the institutions that stand between the individual and the state that we conservatives should celebrate. And of course, if I may quote him one more time, Edmund Burke himself makes this point very famously when he said the following: "To be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affections. It's the first link in the series by which we proceed towards a love to our country and to mankind." But if you reflect on that quote, what he's saying about the little platoon, if you think about it, little platoon is part of an army, the germ of an affection towards something that is national and beyond. And the other part of the story is to remember where the national fits in. What's the role for macro conservatism in this model? Because we conservatives, in our battle against the state, must not also battle against the nation. We must remember that national greatness, that national distinctiveness is an important element in conservative principles, an important part of our political argument. After all, Adam Smith's book was not the wealth of individuals, it was the wealth of nations that he wrote about. And in Britain, certainly, one of the most powerful arguments that we conservatives had is the way in which the nation state is being squeezed by the development of European federalism and by perhaps the threats of a global economy. And what's the conservative argument about the nation here? My argument there would be that our progressive liberals misunderstand globalization. What Tony Blair believes is that globalization means Britain has got to get more like everyone else. He thinks globalization is a process whereby we are all homogenized. But it seems to me that that is completely contrary to a conservative instinct and completely contrary to what elementary economic analysis tells you. In a global economy, you're rewarded for being different. In a global economy, you're rewarded for being distinctive. What matters if you had a genuinely integrated global economy, each component national economy in that would be more different from each other because they'd be specializing the things that they were particularly good at. Free market economics rewards comparative advantage, and conservatism is the celebration of distinctiveness, what the economists call comparative advantage. That's why progressive left-wing liberals are the same the world over, but each country has its own conservatism because each country celebrates that which is distinctive. And we had in Britain a case study of this the other week. We have an airline, some of you may have flown it, British Airways, a popular international airline. And the chief executive, who's a great friend of Tony Blair's, had a bright idea. He thought, I'm running an international airline where many of the people flying with us aren't British. Isn't it embarrassing that on the tail fin I've got a Union Jack? Why should someone who isn't British want to fly in an airline that's got the Union Jack on the tail fin? I'm running a great international airline, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to paint the Union Jack off the tail fins of all the British Airways planes. And you had an extraordinary melange of images from Kalahari bushmen to experimental European artists instead of the Union Jack. And what did he discover? What he discovered was that the Union Jack on the British Airways planes was not something to be embarrassed about. The Union Jack on the British Airways planes was the brand identity of British Airways. And the reason why people around the world flew British Airways was because the Union Jack conveyed to them a certain set of ideas about what the experience of flying on the airline might be all about. And what's happened? The chief executive has been sacked and the Union Jack is being painted back on to the tail fins. And what I hope is that when we fight our general election, probably next year, the British people will do the same. Thank you very much.